Great.
Away.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to present my work to you. It has been done in collaboration with Enno Malwitz and Jean-Luc Lenas, my PhD supervisor. And to motivate my talk, I will first describe briefly why we think the original Big Bang theory is incomplete and how we can do better. Now, the standard answer is inflation, but we'll see that there are reasons to look for alternative theories. I will then present two such alternative theories. The first one is non-minimal ekpyrosis, in which there's a non-minimal kinetic coupling between my two scalar fields. I will calculate the non-Gaussianities in this model and compare them to observations. And the second part of my talk, I will talk about conflation, which is a scalar tensor theory of gravity. And what I will show is that you can get accelerated expansion with a negative potential, which, you know, you don't normally get in inflation. Now, the early universe has been extraordinarily simple. Not only is it flat, homogeneous, and isotropic, but it has nearly scale invariant Gaussian density fluctuations. And we want to explain this initial state somehow dynamically. Of course, we could just, you know, impose special initial conditions, but that's not what we want to do. Let me just briefly describe what I mean by special initial conditions. For example, if you look at the cosmic microwave background, or I'm sure you've all seen the picture from the Planck satellite or WMAP before, you can see all these like fluctuations, but these are really, really tiny. The actual average temperature is basically constant across the sky. Yet two places in the sky, two regions, which are separated by more than about 2 degrees, have never been in causal contact, simply because there hasn't been enough time since the CMB, or if you go back in time, since the Big Bang, for them to exchange any information. And yet they're at the same temperature. To solve it, we have to somehow extend space-time to pre-Big Bang times, and by Big Bang here, I mean the old Big Bang, the original Big Bang theory, so that they're somehow causally connected and can exchange information. Another problem comes from the fact that the spatial curvature we observe today is very, very close to zero, so spatial curvature is very close to being flat. Up there you can see the Friedmann equation, which shows you how different energy density content in the universe scales with the scale factor A. And you can see that at early times, so for small a, the first term, the curvature term, will dominate over the matter term, radiation term, and anisotropy term. So that means that if we extrapolate back from today to the Planck time, just a rough estimate, you see that the curvature at the Planck time has to be of order, well, 60 orders of magnitude smaller still. So we have to somehow start out with an extremely flat universe to get to the universe we observe today. There are two ways in which this problem can be solved dynamically, namely inflation and ekpyrosis. If you have a phase of ultra-fast expansion, that is, if your scale factor grows rapidly and the Hubble parameter is almost constant, you can see that at late times, this flatness parameter, omega k, is driven towards zero. On the other hand, in the analogous case, if A is approximately constant, but the Hubble parameter grows rapidly, you can achieve the same effect going towards the bounds. In the same way, we produce density perturbations, nearly scale invariant density perturbations. The horizon, which is the region of causal contact, goes like 1 over h. So in inflation, we just saw that h is approximately constant, but the scale factor stretches our quantum fluctuations so that they exit the horizon at late times. Analogously, if the scale factor is approximately constant, the perturbations will stay approximately constant, but the horizon, which goes like 1 over h, will shrink, so that in the same way, the perturbations will exit the horizon. And when they do so, the quantum fluctuations get squeezed, and we end up with a stochastic distribution of classical density perturbations. I will show you in a bit that in the ekpyrotic models, we actually need two scalar fields to make this work. Now, let me just quickly show you how such a scalar field would enter in the Friedmann equation. That's how it would scale with the equation of state W. And we can see that in an expanding universe, I mean, I already told you this term would dominate. So what we need is for this exponent here to be less than 2. So for the scalar field to dominate the dynamics, we need W less than minus a third. And you can model that in a positive potential where the field is like slowly rolling, like on a plateau like here. On the other hand, in ekpyrosis, to get ultra slow contraction, we want this exponent to be larger than 6. So when A decreases, the scalar field will dominate. And you can easily see that W has to be larger than 1 for that. And the way we can model is it is with a steep negative potential. Okay, I already, you know, can already see that once the scalar field will roll down here, will start oscillating. That's normally when we have reheating, and it will settle down at the minimum. And similarly, I've extended this potential here so that if we enter this minimum, the scalar field can also stabilize. Okay. Now, here's a list of what I think are important issues with inflation. This list is obviously not complete, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but I would be happy to talk about all these afterwards in more detail. Inflation has unlikely initial conditions. Penrose has shown that, or in terms of an entropy argument, that yes, today's conditions are special, but compared to inflation, the inflationary conditions are even more special. Similarly, Neil, together with Gary Gibbons, has shown that yes, inflation is an attractor, but actually small durations, short durations of inflation are exponentially preferred, so that we don't actually get enough inflation to solve the horizon and flatness problem. Now, the next point here is maybe more of an aesthetic one. I think it's possible to get inflation in string theory, or people claim so. However, it's quite hard since string theory seems to prefer negative potentials.
That may well just be a feature of constructions people have done.
Yeah.
Unless you know some argument that I thought were.
Sorry?
That may just be a feature of the easiest things to construct.
Well, yes, but you know, that's normally what we try first, the easiest way.
Sure.
But yeah, of course. Of course. I mean, you know, that's what the second part of my talk is about, that we can actually get accelerated expansion with a negative potential. So, you know, that's like the motivation.
Keep going.
Okay, thanks. One thing that the BICEP2 non-observation of primordial gravitational waves has shown us is that you can tweak the inflationary theory in a way to like fit almost any observation, right? I mean, you know, Andre Linde called it the smoking gun of inflation. And it's not there, and inflation is still good. So, you know, still fine. And then this last point, you know that the small quantum fluctuations, I already showed you that when they exit the horizon, they will, you know, they're turned into density fluctuations, which are basically the temperature fluctuations that we see in the CMB, which are then the seeds for large-scale structure that we observe today. But then if we also take rare large quantum fluctuations into account, that means that there will be a region where inflation just keeps going. So, you know, might end later because the field is kicked back up the potential. Within this region, I mean, it will expand in volume so that there will again be rare fluctuations, big fluctuations. Oh, I think the power is not actually turned on. Is there a way to like... Okay. Let's hope the laptop doesn't die. Okay, so you know, you repeat this process and you will make more patches of universe with basically every possible physical properties. So you end up with a multiverse where anything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. So now inflation is not complete anymore. You need to add a measure to regularize these infinities. This sort of multiverse is evaded in Ekpyrosis, because here, what happens if you have these rare large quantum fluctuations, you will just, you know, contract a bit more, and these regions will not compete in volume. Also, the theory is actually falsifiable. If we would detect primordial gravitational waves, we would, you know, be able to rule it out. Okay, now some more details on Ekpyrosis. I already mentioned that we need a second scalar field to make the perturbations come out right. That is because if we only had one, the adiabatic perturbations produced would actually stay quantum, so they would not be amplified, and also they would pick up a blue spectrum. So we need two fields. And the way this works is with the so-called entropic mechanism. It's a two-stage process in which we first produce nearly scalar invariant Gaussian entropy perturbations, and then we have to convert them into curvature perturbations, which will happen by bending the field space trajectory. Now I'll show you in a bit how it works in detail. The way we parameterize the co-moving curvature perturbations, which we can then compare with observations, co-moving curvature perturbation theta, is in this way. The first order in perturbation theory basically gives us the spectrum of our temperature fluctuations that we observe in the CMB. At second order, it's kind of like the square of the linear or Gaussian bit, and this parameter FNL comes from the Fourier transform of the three-point correlation function, and it basically parameterizes how far away from Gaussian our perturbations are. So if this were exactly zero, it would be exactly Gaussian. Similarly, at third order in perturbation theory, you have this GNL parameter called the trispectrum parameter. And here you can see the most recent measurements from the Planck satellite. This is very close to zero. This is also still compatible with zero. I mean, this is only at one sigma. But what we can see already is that these values are rather small. So there's no non-Gaussianity detected yet. Okay. Now, let me compare first the standard entropic mechanism with the new non-minimal entropic mechanism. This here is the standard version. Now, in our theory, we have two fields, which I call phi and chi. And what we can do is we can rotate our field space in such a way that we end up with two new variables, sigma and s, where now the sigma direction is along the trajectory in field space. So the field would basically roll along this direction. And s is the entropic direction orthogonal to it. As you can see, the potential here is unstable. So it, you know, during the ekpyrotic phase, you're supposed to roll along that ridge. In the new non-minimal case, which I've written down Lagrangian here, there are two different features. One, the potential V only depends on one of the scalar fields, phi. That has the consequence that actually you're stable in the entropy direction and you're just rolling down in the sigma direction. And actually the phi and sigma direction are exactly the same now as a consequence. But in addition, you have some non-minimal kinetic coupling to in the kinetic term of the second scalar field, which will then give you nearly scalar invariant entropy perturbations during the ekpyrotic phase. We want to write down perturbations for this Lagrangian up to third order in perturbation theory, which can get rather messy. So what we've done is we've used the so-called covariant formalism, in which we define perturbations via spatial projections of scalar quantities, that is, as covectors. And they vanish for an exact homogeneous and isotropic Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetime. So they naturally play the role of perturbations, even though they can be defined non-perturbatively. Also, one other thing, I will, you know, rewrite the two fields in terms of a field space metric, Gij, where in the standard case, this would just be delta Ij, you know, would be just the trivial case in the standard formalism. Okay, assuming like the standard answers for the scale factor A, namely that it goes like minus t to the 1 over the fast roll parameter epsilon, we can easily get a red tilt in our spectrum. You can read up on it in this paper. But let me focus on non-Gaussianities, namely the bi and the trispectrum. On large scales, we can write the line element in terms of this co-moving curvature perturbation, which you can see is basically just a local perturbation in the scale factor, right? I mean, it's just multiplying the scale factor here. A very nice equation to capture its evolution is given here. And actually, this is valid to all orders in perturbation theory. So what we can do is we can just expand that. And then when we go to co-moving gauge, which, you know, approximately sets the adiabatic perturbation to zero at all orders, the potential will only be a function of the entropy perturbation, delta S. So in order to get the evolution equation for theta, when we expand this equation, we have to solve the equation of motion for the entropy perturbation delta S first up to third order. The way we do this is, I already mentioned it, we use this covariant formalism where we can define an entropy covector in terms of an entropy unit vector times the covariant derivative of my fields phi and chi. We can then calculate the full equation of motion for this, well, for SI, so for the spatial bit, on large scales. And then when we introduce a coordinate system, we will actually get the equation of motion for delta S up to third order in perturbation theory. So I'm not going to, you know, go too much into details in these three steps. Let me just show you what it looks like, what the equation of motion for delta S looks like. Now, I've dropped the superscript 1 here. So this is just the linear delta S, okay? And let me just quickly go through it. You have the Hubble friction term here. The semicolon is a covariant derivative now with respect to the non-trivial field space metric in the double S direction. This theta prime describes the time evolution of my unit vectors in the sigma and S direction. And here you have the Riemann tensor for my non-trivial field space metric. Now, let me just show you the equations at second and third order, just so that you, you know, get an idea what they look like. In second order, it's obviously a bit more complicated because now we not only have the same thing as second order, but we get additional terms which go, for example, like delta S prime squared or delta S prime, and delta S squared. And just for fun, because I worked a long time to get this equation, this is the one at third order. you can see, you know, you get all the different combinations of like first and second order and like first order cubed contributions. Okay, now what we have to do is solve this equation to get the solution for delta S 1, 2, and 3. What we do first is we solve it during the ekpyrotic phase where things will actually simplify a lot. For once, the field space trajectory is straight, which directly means that this this theta prime is equal to zero. And you can see it comes up quite a lot. yeah.
Did you fix a gauge here? Or is this a gauge?
Yeah, we're in co-moving gauge now. Okay. But delta S, the entropy perturbation, is actually a gauge invariant variable.
Correct.
So it doesn't matter. But yeah, we're in co-moving gauge.
Okay. But nevertheless, everything's still covariant with respect
exactly,
to the field space.
Exactly, exactly. It was like the guiding principle, actually, in deriving this equation has to be covariant. Yeah. And you know, you can see like double covariant derivatives on the Riemann tensor, etc. Okay, So during the ekphorotic phase, first stage, we solve these equations, and what we find actually is that the entropy perturbation at second and third order are exactly equal to zero, which is, you know, if you look at that, it's a non-trivial result. So in addition to theta prime being zero, you have delta S2 and delta S3 equal to zero. Yeah, this actually, you know, non-trivial, because you also have to redefine what your entropy perturbation is at third order. But I don't want to, you know.
Is there an explanation for
that? That's a good question. let's talk about it later, because then I can show you how we actually redefine things, which makes a difference, obviously. Mm-hmm. Now, already, you know, I showed you.
I almost hinted at some argument about why the adiabatic mode is perturbed over its constant outside the horizon fully non-linearly.
Sorry, say it again.
So Malvicena in his original paper had this argument for why the adiabatic mode, in the way he parameterizes it, is like e to the 2 zeta or something. Some specific non-linear parameterization such that it would be constant outside the horizon even non-linearly, is the guiding principle here as well.
Yeah. Right. Remember that equation for theta prime? I've now expanded it to first order at the top. And you can see that during the ekphorotic phase, there's this factor omega prime, so it just goes to zero. At second order, it's not so easy anymore. I mean, this term will go to zero as the theta prime and actually also delta S2. This time will go to zero, but these two terms are non-zero, and actually they cancel exactly. So, you know, that was one of the first results. This is why this theory seemed to be very interesting, because what that translates into is that this FNL parameter during the ekphorotic phase exactly zero.
Can they cancel for this particular choice of potential, or they cancel for any potential?
Yes, you need some relationship between V, comma sigma and V,
SS. Yeah, but the fact, I mean, this is because our potential did not depend on chi, the second scalar field. So the fact that it only depends on phi makes it vanish.
But did you use the ekphorotic background anywhere, or would this also vanish?
No, this is in the ekphorotic background, yeah. Okay, now at third order, there are a few more terms, but you know, this will go to zero. This has delta S2 will go to zero. Similar for that one, theta prime goes to zero here as well, here and there. So we're only left with these two terms here, but actually during the ekphorotic phase, all the potentials, all the potential derivatives with an odd number of derivatives in the s direction also vanish. So this is also zero.
Why is that? They vanish. Is there a symmetry potential?
It looks like there should be.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just calculated it, and that's how it turns out.
For
it's
a
just. No, the only requirement is that V only depends on phi. Yeah, and then because you know you get because these are covariant derivatives, you get terms with like Christoffel symbols, and then that will make it all cancel, so that you end up with zero. Okay, so you know that's an interesting result here, but this is only the first step in our two-step entropic mechanism, right? Now we have produced exactly Gaussian entropy perturbations, but we have to convert them into the curvature perturbations that we then observe in the CMB. So let's try and do that. The way we can do it is by modeling it with a repulsive potential. I mentioned it earlier. What we need is, so we're coming in here, what we need is for the field space trajectory to bend. And you know, we can model this with repulsive potentials. We've used different types of potentials to see whether the form, the exact form, influences it much. It doesn't. The problem is that now, because of this bending in the trajectory, theta prime is not zero anymore. So remember the long equations? Not so simple to solve anymore. So we actually had to solve it numerically. One thing we find immediately is that our non-trivial field space metric actually has to become relatively close to trivial again during the conversion. Otherwise, what would happen if this was still significant, you would really like kind of multiply this potential by a lot. So what would happen is that you would come in here, and as soon as you feel the potential, you would like immediately be deflected. And this immediate deflection is equivalent to getting huge non-Gaussianities. So what we want for small non-Gaussianities is for this bend in the trajectory to be rather smooth, so that the conversion can be efficient and happens over like one e-fold or so. To do the calculation numerically, we of course have to assume a functional form for this omega, which if you remember was the chi-chi component of my field space metric Gij in the kinetic term for the second scalar field. And for example, we used looked at different forms, but one of them was a Bessel function, modified Bessel function of the first kind. The reason we chose it was that this leads to a constant slope in the time derivative of the scalar curvature. So it's really a good way to parameterize how close to trivial we are, because for a trivial field space metric, R would just go to zero. Now what I've plotted here, okay, so let's plot against R prime, and the different curves are for different durations of the conversion. Remember, I showed you in the last slide how it bends. So if it bends like really quickly, more like sharply, that's when we're up here for like half an e-fold of conversion duration. When we bend more smoothly, we're down here for one e-fold. And you can see, well, you can see two things. First of all, the smoother the conversion process, so the closer we go to here, the smaller FNL gets. And the second thing is that the smaller R prime, so the closer we are to a trivial field space metric, all of these will actually converge. And, you know, we end up with quite a small range. Also, if you look at the tri-spectrum parameter GNL, you can see that, well, FNL can take either sign, but GNL is always, and we found that for other examples as well, it's always negative, and it's of order 10 to the 2 or 10 to the 3. So this is actually a possibly observable signature for these kind of models.
What are the numbers on the curves? Half, two thirds, three
quarters? It's the number of e-folds of the evolution of mod AH. So it parameterizes the duration of the conversion.
So the longer it is, the less non-Gaussian.
Exactly. So the smoother it is, the longer it lasts. Exactly. Yeah, that's the smooth. okay.
Does that presumably also affects the amplitude of the? If it took infinitely long, you'd get no perturbations at all.
Yeah. Exactly.
So it's related to the fine tuning you like required to get the density perturbations.
Yeah. Exactly. And for, you know, a duration of like one e-fold, that's fine with the amplitude. So that would be like a range that we would expect. So just to summarize this first bit, we don't get a measure problem like we do in inflation for non-minimal ekphorosis. However, we do need a second scalar field for the perturbations to come out right. We improve the initial conditions because the potential is stable in comparison to the standard mechanism. But then we also need a conversion from entropy to curvature perturbations. And this conversion has to be efficient or smooth or last long enough. It's all the same, saying the same things, to get an FNL, which is fine with what we observe. Now, there's a non-trivial relationship between the two. So, I mean, you could argue that there's some tuning to get to small FNL, you know, to be compatible with observations. But this cannot be changed. If you want small, relatively small FNL, your GNL will be of this order and negative. and you compare that to a single field inflation, if you trust the predictions, you tend to get these parameters of order one due to reheating after inflation. Okay, now the second part. If we not only substitute the Big Bang with the bounds, but also relax the assumption that GR is valid at those times, and replace it with a scalar tensor theory of gravity, we can write down an action like this up here. The J is for Jordan frame, which means that our gravity term is multiplied by a field-dependent function, F. Also notice that I've allowed for a parameter K in the kinetic term, which allows it to be negative. And also notice that our matter Lagrangian couples to the Jordan frame metric now. This is important because it means that observers made out of this matter will actually observe the dynamics as they are in Jordan frame. Okay, so this is the important bit. This theory can be reformulated in terms of the Einstein frame by applying a conformal transformation of this kind and also redefining the field from capital phi to small phi in this way here, so that we end up with an Einstein frame Lagrangian of this type. And the way we've set this up is to actually get ekparosis in Einstein frame. So that's our input. And then what we wanted to do is wanted to see whether it's possible at all to get accelerated expansion in Jordan frame. Okay? So that was what we tried to do. We took this ansatz where f goes like capital phi squared and exponential in little phi. And it turns out that yes, it is possible to get accelerated expansion in Jordan frame under certain conditions. To get accelerated expansion, we need this this gamma here to be larger than one. And also to avoid ghosts, we actually need for k to be negative. Yeah, very counterintuitive. And this psi, this parameter here, to be larger than the sixth. Now, maybe you think this is surprising, but you know, maybe all your intuition for what the kinetic term, the sign of the kinetic term should be, is derived from Einstein frame dynamics. And if you would write down the perturbations in Jordan frame, you would get an additional term coming from this coupling here that would then avoid getting ghosts.
Same thing happens in string theory.
Yeah.
Kinetic term is like the wrong side in string frame.
Yeah. I mean, this is also where, you know, this ansatz comes from. Exactly.
And C is...
Come back. Sorry, yes?
And C can be sufficiently big such that square root such
exactly.
Information is okay.
Exactly. So, well, C has to be larger than square root of 6, but this comes from the fact that we want to have an ekparotic phase in Einstein frame. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course, you could use, you know, different potentials and so on, but this is, you know, the easiest standard way to get ekparosis. Now, you just saw gamma has to be larger than 1, so if we pick gamma equal to 2, we'll get...
those have conditions for the scalar mode to be non-ghostly?
Yeah, both scalar and tensor ghosts, and actually consistent. Yeah, it's the same condition. Okay, so taking gamma equal to 2, you get minus phi cubed potential, which we've plotted here. It's the blue curve. Now, if you just had the blue curve, conflation would just go on. But obviously, we want to end the phase. So in a first attempt to try and end this phase, we just shifted this potential by adding a small constant and, you know, just put in the numerics and checked what happened. So we have a negative potential, but the scalar field, due to all these dynamics, will actually roll up the potential instead of rolling down. And what happens if we look at the equation of state parameter, remember it has to be less than minus a third for accelerated expansion to happen. That was the same case as inflation. And we can see, so minus a third is like here. And we can see that in the beginning, when we just roll up this negative potential, we'll get this conflationary phase. And then because we enter positive values, it will stop expanding. Okay, so what does this look like?
Sorry, what's the vertical coordinate in that graph?
W. Sorry.
So you're going from acceleration to expansion to
normal. Yeah, you can see it in the next slide as well. The scalar field here will just roll up this potential, so towards smaller values, that's why it's going down here, and it will continue. The scale factor in Jordan frame will increase, so that is expansion, okay. Now, the problem comes in when we try to end this phase with this shift in the potential, because what happens is that the scalar field will run approximately to 0.4, and then we'll roll back down, okay? What this means is that we actually get recontraction, so the scale factor reaches a maximum, and then it decreases again, so we get contraction here. And you can see that, I'm not going to go into detail, but you can see that the Hubble parameter and Jordan frame will go to zero at these maximum and minimum values. Okay, so this doesn't work too well, because what we end up with is a collapsing universe. It's not what we want. but we can think about what should actually happen in Einstein frame. I already said in the beginning that we want to recover GR towards late times. That's what we observe today. What that means is that Einstein frame and Jordan frame actually have to become equivalent. The scalar field has to stabilize. I mean, that's the equivalent statement, because you remember that function f of phi multiplying the gravity term r. If phi is constant, then we can just rewrite it in terms of standard GR. What this means is that in Einstein frame, because we're contracting, we have to somehow get back to the expansion we observe today, so we have to bounce. So in Einstein frame, what we did is we added a ghost condensate bounce at phi approximately equal to minus 4. So what will happen is the scalar field will roll down. We have the ekpyrotic phase in Einstein frame. We'll come back up. There will be a bounce in Einstein frame. And then we will drop into this minimum and oscillate a bit before we stabilize at the minimum. Okay. The way this looks like in Einstein frame, as I just said, we start with the potential. We roll down the potential now in Einstein frame, right? There will be a bounce at approximately phi equal to minus 4 here. You can see it in the scale factor. And then we will roll, well, we're rolling back up the potential and then into this dip and oscillate and settle at the minimum. Okay? So this is not surprising. the scale factor after this bounce will just go on increasing. Now, in Jordan frame, so we can now take the solution Einstein frame and transform it into Jordan frame. What will happen is that you very, very quickly roll up the potential. Remember the minus phi cubed potential, you will roll it up. So you start here at approximately 2.5 and you go towards very small values. And this is the conflationary phase where the scale factor increases rapidly. And then you will basically sit up there for a while, right? During which the scale factor just keeps on increasing a bit. And then there's some interesting dynamics here. Also note that the bounce in Einstein frame doesn't actually lead to anything dramatic here. I mean, you know, we end the conflationary phase and we just keep expanding. But there's something interesting happening here. So let me zoom in to these oscillations. And what you can see is that at some point, so we're basically coming in here, the scale factor keeps increasing, and at some point, we again recontract. This is when we, this is when we enter the dip in the Einstein frame potential, if you remember. We start oscillating, and these oscillations actually get translated in oscillations in the field in Jordan frame, and also the scale factor in Jordan frame. So while the scalar field oscillates, you get recontraction and another bounce and another recontraction until at some point you settle at the minimum and you will just keep expanding. And then because the scalar field is stabilized, your Einstein frame and your Jordan frame will basically be the same. So you just keep expanding. Okay. an interesting question for the future would be to see how we could, you know, how reheating could enter this picture. Because, I mean, this is a bit strange, right? I mean, you wouldn't, we want one bounce, yes, to get from contraction to expansion. Well, it's what the observers see, you know, the matter that I've coupled.
True.
But yeah, no, it's just, you know, an interesting.
There's no theorem saying it's not
balanced. I know. yeah, but, you know, could still see whether reheating could happen in this way somehow. Okay. So that's part two. I've shown you that it's possible to get a phase of accelerated expansion with a negative potential in scalar tensor theory of gravity. I have combined different elements from inflation and ekphorosis. For example, the fact that we don't get eternal inflation multiverse. It's one of the plus points, definitely. If we want to get density perturbations, we have to add an entropic mechanism like in the first part. And to get a graceful exit, we have to include a bounce in Einstein frame. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't want to interrupt you in the talk, but I strongly disagree about the statement about a major problem.
Yeah.
I want to ask you the following question is, in your model, what is the our current value of CC?
Of CC?
Are we living in a false vacuum with very small cosmological constant, right?
Oh, the cosmological constant, okay. Well, I haven't talked about the embedding of this in some sort of cyclic theory. I mean, in this picture, you know, you settle in some minimum.
Yes.
Positive minimum. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's no reason why it should be small or large or whatever.
Yeah.
So I haven't actually addressed this issue, that's true.
Yeah, I don't want to ask, I'm not asking about addressing that problem. I'm just pointing out that if we live in a false vacuum right now, and it doesn't decay fast enough, then
yeah.
we already have a major problem. It's already a universe. It's not about inflation.
Yeah.
Right? We live in here, it's expanding, and it doesn't decay fast enough, then sooner or later anything will happen.
That's true. If you have a dark energy phase that would just continue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's also one of the reasons why, you know, embedding it in a cyclic picture would be nice, because then if the dark energy phase is just not long enough and you would enter again the ekphorotic phase and, you know, cycle again, then
but
you would avoid the problem.
If you have an infinite number of cycles, then you still have a major problem.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it's obviously not as bad as the inflationary one.
Actually, why do you say there's a problem? There's not a problem. You have an infinite number of cycles.
Sorry?
Do you say there's a multiverse problem?
When you have an infinite number of cycles,
yeah.
anything can happen, happens infinite number of cycles.
That doesn't happen at all.
Sorry?
There can be a stable attractor which prevents that happening. The system can be statistically homogeneous in time.
Ah, you mean you want every bounce to be identical, so you can avoid this problem?
No, you just want that over long times the system is statistically homogeneous. Doesn't mean that every bounce is identical, it just means
that is choosing a major
ensemble.
I agree, and that implicitly is a choosing major of unit time you count this.
I don't think so. Unit time?
Right, so when you see how, when you count how frequent things happen and how to arrive at a vector, you choose a major of how you weight different events in your time history. That is choosing a major.
Okay.
You might be a
very natural measure. It's a very
natural
measure. The system is statistically, you know, if you can define a time such that it is statistically homogeneous in that time, then that's a very natural measure.
If I change time into a measure, then that is a solution to the major problem in any case. I'm just pointing out that whenever things happen infinite number of times, infinite number of occasions, you need to regularize them. There's always a major involved.
Yeah, but in a statistically homogeneous ensemble, there really isn't a problem.
You might think there is a very natural measure to choose in that one.
Absolutely.
And some other people might think in other cases there are also natural measures to choose.
But then they would be worried about normal statistical mechanics. I mean, normal statistical mechanics, if the system is, you know, statistically homogeneous, either in space or time, then that's the measure to use.
Yeah, but So, well, that is assuming you can get this model to be statistically homogeneous.
Right.
First.
Right.
Then,
right.
You have
that. That's the goal. I guess that's the goal. And so far, we don't know if there's any roadblock.
And I guess the second question is, sorry,
yeah.
I'm dominating the question. It's how, like, in what sense, in how big the improvement is about the initial conditions? Like, can you quantify that? Like, how, what's
yeah.
the fraction of initial condition you set inflation, what's the condition you set?
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't compared it in terms of numbers, but I mean, there are these arguments that for inflation to start at all, you have to be, you know, you have to be already homogeneous enough over, you know, a big region.
Yeah, enough. But there's a recent paper telling you enough is actually quite loose. A recent paper by Matt Clifton and some other, Matt Clifton and some other people.
Well, then how would you counter Penrose's and Neil's argument?
Sorry?
How would you counter Penrose's entropy argument and Neil's argument?
Well, Penrose's entropy give you a measure of which initial condition should be weighed, how you should weigh the initial condition, right? You will choose a different ways to weight, you can favor inflation. If you will weight lower initial point, you have as short as inflation as you can have, as disfavoring inflation, and I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, Penrose's argument just relies on Lugo theorem. So if you say that today's universe is a rare configuration,
mm-hmm.
then the initial conditions have to be equally rare. I mean, since the dynamics is reversible,
mm-hmm.
the dynamics behind inflation is irreversible. I mean, there are irreversible processes, but they're not invoked in inflation. The equations one uses are reversible. So then, by definition, you haven't solved any problem by picking some initial condition. You know, it has to be at least as rare as the final.
So how do you do that here? Because these are reversible as well.
Yeah, it's true. It's true that's reversible dynamics don't solve.
They can only change what question you're asking, but I'm not worried about the fact that I'm living in oxygen and not in vacuum.
Right.
So it can be that kind of change.
Right. I mean, naively, the ekbarovic picture is much better than inflation for the following reason. Basically, let me just see if I can remember the argument.
Well, I mean, there's the obvious argument that for like a constant potential,
mm-hmm.
you know, for inflation, and this I think is your argument that the kinetic term goes like 108 to the 6. So if you go back in time,
yeah.
It will dominate.
Right,
and then
so if you look at it in phase space, if you
yeah.
really look at the correct canonical momentum. Position, then Bruegel's theory tells you that there's no such thing as an attractor. You know,
attractor for what?
For a dynamical system. If you have a reversible dynamical system.
The volume of phase space.
Yeah, volume of it's always invariant and conserved. So there's no
yeah.
such thing as an attractor in that way of looking at it.
For singularity speaking.
As long as you have a reversible system. Selective measure. It's only when you look at things which are not the actual measure on phase space, when you
mm-hmm.
look at just the position and velocity of the field, for example,
mm-hmm.
you might be tricked into thinking there's an attractor.
Sorry, Fred, I don't understand the point.
What?
If you don't look at the phase space volume, what do you look at?
Well, if you do look at phase space volume, you don't see any such thing as an attractor.
I mean, if you don't coarse-grain anything, but everything is always occupying a single phase space form.
Well, take some distribution of the states or something. The volume of that is going to be preserved in phase space
mm-hmm.
because
yes.
of Lugel's theorem.
Yes.
So that what we mean by when we say there's an attractor in inflation, we're looking at like a plus phi and phi dot that
mm-hmm.
that a field and canonical momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And in that phi phi dot, if you just take a naive measure on that space, then it's
mm-hmm.
So you're saying that inflation
you know,
is not
that,
an attractor?
That's an argument against thermal equilibrium. So it's a bit of a dangerous argument because it says no system ever equilibrates, which we know it does. So in the end, it always depends on which question you ask, and you have to coarse grain and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so
how
you choose the coarse grain.
Exactly.
So the difficulty with inflation can be phrased the following way, is if I had 60 folds of inflation, and I look at the distribution of the scalar field and scale factor on phase space, what I'll find is that the scalar field, and I'm just including reversible dynamics, the phase of the oscillation of the scalar field is fine-tuned to e to the minus 180. So that for a fixed, let's say, value of the Hubble constant, I can predict exactly where the scalar field is after inflation. So however much inflation I have, I know exactly where the scalar field is. So you could say, you know, we don't really understand the measure of gravity, but we think we know what the measure is on scalar fields in a given background. And inflation fine-tunes that coordinate of the scalar field to e to the minus 180, the 60 people. If you try to do the same argument with ekphorosis, that's not what happens. For ekphorosis, you can get all phases of the scalar field roughly equal after the ekphorotic phase. So, you know, it's a bit funny because you're saying that my measure is going to be the late time measure when gravity is just an adiabatic expansion effect. And I simply might use the normal stat net of a scalar field in an expanding background, where the background, I don't include that in the measure. And then you'll find that ekphorotic is generic and inflation is exponentially rapid. So a lot of people say, well, that's ridiculous to use a measure that's in the future. You should use the measure that's in the past. And I think so far we haven't, what we'd like to do is do the same kind of calculation but in the past. Inflation, you can't do it because gravity, you know, is really important there. We don't know what the measure is when you include gravity. But if you have a bounce, so you need to have a bouncing scenario which could either give inflation or ekphorosis and check which one is more likely. I think something could be done. Hasn't been done yet.
Yeah. Yeah, so you said that you can use scalar fields and you know those scenarios. So why is that?
If you only have one, you do produce adiabatic perturbations, right, in that field.
Okay.
But they, well, first of all, they get a blue spectrum. But more importantly, they don't actually get amplified. So
right.
They're not like, they basically stay quantum. They don't get amplified into classical perturbations. That's only been shown like 2 years ago, actually.
Okay.
So we wouldn't actually observe them.
Yeah, I see. So that assumption that you make that the potential only depends on the one field, how general is that?
That's a good question. That's something I would like to look into in the future, to like actually have an additional dependence on the second scalar field and see what happens. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, this is the most simple realization, and
yeah.
It, you know, has these nice properties, so we looked at that first.
Yeah.
Can you say a little more what you required of this function Gij, the coefficient of the second, the flat fields, kinetic term?
Yeah.
What did you have to assume for that?
Well, in the first time we investigated this model, we just chose an exponential of a similar type, like the potential. And then, you know, if you parameterize it in the same way, you can actually show that the parameter C in the potential, and if you call it B in the omega, if they're equal, then you get exactly scaling invariant perturbations. Right. But there's been a paper.
You have to correlate it with the potential.
Yes.
To get
scalar invariant. Exactly. They have to work together.
Is there any rationale why they should be the same?
No. what you can show is that because the ekphorotic phase has to end, C will generally vary with time, and that will introduce that red tilt. There's also been a paper by Anna Ias and Paul Steiner that show that you don't need exponentials. You know, they've done it with different functional forms, but
and
yes, there always has to be
exactly.
Yeah, that's the point.
So in inflation, I mean, basically the reason you get scalar variance is because the De Sitter metric is invariant under rescale.
Yeah.
I rescale T and X. If you write the De Sitter metric in conformally flat form, it's obvious that the line element is invariant under rescale. So in ekphorosis, you require this coincidence.
right, to get the same scaling variance.
Yeah, so it would be interesting to see.
It would be interesting if there's some argument, some symmetry, which would relate to the potential.
Yeah, definitely. It's also a good, good point to look into, yeah.
Any other questions? Thanks for bringing it.